The best-selling author Deborah Tannen writes about the passionate relationships between sisters. In her new book, Tannen explores various aspects of what she calls sisterness. The book is called You Were Always Mom's Favorite. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg, who can be objective about this subject because she is an only child, examines this book about caring, competition, comparison, and closeness.
You Were Always Mom's Favorite. Deborah Tannen, I'm not going to ask you whether that was true about you, but you are the youngest of three sisters. Do all siblings feel this way?
I think yes. Whenever I talked to women about their sisters, they would tell me who was the favorite. Now, they didn't always agree. Our perceptions aren't always right. But yeah, we think in those terms.
Yeah. And you say that nobody really shares your life the way sister to sister can, that you're closer in age than you are with your parents. That's an extremely important relationship too, of course, but nothing like the sister relationship. And you're moving through history pretty much at the same time, and you're the same gender, so that's different in most cases from your relationship to your husband.
Yeah, in some ways, the siblings and especially sisters are more influential in your childhood than your parents because you're together more. Sometimes it's a very positive effect. Your older sister was always protective of you. But you also hear from people whose entire lives they feel inadequate because of something the sister teased them about. Her ear stuck out. She looked funny when she smiled. She uses words wrong. A woman in her 70s told me it. If anyone corrects her use of a word, she really reacts to that because her sister always told her that she used words wrong, and it made her feel stupid.
Well, you write that it is a relationship about competition and also definition. And those are very interrelated. One is the pretty one, one's the smart one, one's the athletic one, one's
the bookworm,
and on and on.
That comparison, it can be frustrating because you feel you're pigeonholed. You know, I can't draw. I couldn't even think of drawing because my sister was the one who was supposed to have that talent. And sometimes it gives you a starting point from which to decide who you're going to be. So one woman's sister, they were adults. She said, did you ever wonder why I played the bagpipes? And she said, well, why did you? Because you didn't. A chance to define yourself in comparison, but also sometimes in opposition.
Well, you keep talking about sisterness, but you're also talking so much about birth order, and that's central to it too, isn't it? Because the oldest is always mother-like in some way.
Right. There's another story I heard that was so moving. A woman recalls she was about 7 and her sister about 14 when their mother died, and the older sister was trying to take care of her, was buttering bread. And the bread tore. You know, the butter was hard, and the bread was that white bread, and the bread tore. And she was so angry. She thought a real mother wouldn't tear the bread. And her sister was angry because a real mother wouldn't have died. It is such a moving story.
Yeah.
And how touching that a 14-year-old is trying to be a mother to the 7-year-old.
And who's mothering her.
But who is mothering her?
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times I heard from younger sisters that their older sisters were bossy and judgmental. So you ask why? Think of the older one who always knows better, has a right, and maybe is assigned the task of telling the younger ones what to do, and maybe it becomes a habit.
But that bossiness and the judgmentalness, in a way, I hope this doesn't sound too Pollyanna-ish because I'm an only child, is the flip side of caring, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, it's the double meaning of the word bond. Hmm. There's the bond of a connection and there's the bond of bondage. You have a close bond. That's the positive thing. It's the connection. But when you're connected to somebody, everything each one does affects the other. And it's a kind of bondage. You're not as free as you would be if that person wasn't in your life.
The older one also has every burden, really, as well as so many pleasures, but is always expected not only to be the perpetual caretaker and teacher, but also the problem solver. That's the one everybody else goes to.
Yes, many older sisters or older siblings find the younger ones are always calling, asking for help, asking. And one older sister told me something very interesting. She was starting to get annoyed at that role, and it struck her. She is taking the role of problem solver, and she never tells them her problems. So no wonder they think of her as having none.
Mm-hmm.
So she just made a concerted effort that she would tell them her problems the same way she does with her friends. And it felt funny at first, but she got used to it. And it did make the relationship more adult and more equal.
And that's something you can't do right away. You can't do that as when you're very young. You have to have a certain age.
And sometimes it has to be a concerted effort because our ways of relating to each other become like habits. And then we also relate to the whole world that way.
Deborah Tannen, we've been talking about sisters. I think it's time to meet yours. We have them on the line. Naomi Tannen, 8 years old. Are you with us?
Sam.
Hi, Nay.
Hello, Deb.
And Mimi Tannen, 2 years older than Deborah?
Yes, I'm here, too.
Oh, good.
Hi, Mim.
Hi, Deb. Hi, Nay.
So, ladies, which of you was your mother's favorite?
Oh, that's a good first question.
Mimi?
Clearly me, no question.
Oh, and Naomi was clearly you, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know about that.
Deborah, what do you
think? At times in my life, I thought it was Mimi, and at other times, I thought it was Naomi.
And never you?
Are you kidding? Mom's favorite? No chance anyone's going to say me, right?
She was more involved with you than any of the three of us.
Maybe after I was on Oprah, but not before.
Oh, golly. Ladies, I hate to interrupt this little family reunion, but I'm so glad we had it. Thank you so much. Deborah Tannen, author of You Were Always Mom's Favorite, joined by Naomi Tannen and Mimi Tannen, proving their younger siblings' subtitle, Sisters in Conversation Throughout Their Lives. This is the third book that Deborah Tannen has dedicated to her sisters. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
Lori Moore's new novel manages to be both playful and powerful. The Gate at the Stairs is the story of a year, happens to begin in 2001, in the life of 20-year-old Tassie Kelchin, the small-town daughter of a farmer who grows what amount to designer potatoes for fancy restaurants in Chicago and Evanston. Tassie's become a college student in a Midwestern town that has a few Chinese restaurants and people who talk about Sylvia Plath, so Tassie finds it cosmopolitan. She takes a job as a part-time nanny for a couple that can seem appealing, appalling, and mysterious, and surprised to find that she rather likes the child that they adopt. Over the year, Tassie's parents grow older. The couple she works for grow more mysterious. Her brother finds himself, and she finds spaces in her heart that she never knew. Lori Moore joins us from the studios of WHA in Madison. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And we usually don't slavishly cite reviews, but boy, these have been good, haven't they?
Some of them, yes.
Well, all
some
the ones I've read, so nice. Let's say all the important ones.
Okay, that's right, all the important ones.
The events of September 11th, which in this book are called the events of September, loom over the story without ever being the center of the story, really. Which raises the question, why did you choose to begin the story in the fall of 2001, as opposed to the fall of 2000.
It's when there was a kind of passivity and fear and acquiescence going on as we watched the Bush administration use this event to make a case for an invasion of Iraq. And one of the several themes in the book is that kind of passivity and acquiescence, both in the personal realm and in the public realm. That's what I was interested in that strange kind of hiatus between 9/11 and then March 2003 when Iraq was invaded.
Do you write every day?
I try, but it's, you know, my life is very crowded, so I try to take notes at least every day.
Mm-hmm. When you say your life is very crowded, do you mean, among other things, teaching?
Teaching. I'm a single mom. I have to go on a book tour next week, so...
This is your first novel in 15 years, right?
Oh, my God. Yeah, I guess, I mean, time flies. What can I tell you?
Well, it's not as if you haven't been writing, but you write short stories, collections.
Right. I've written book reviews. I've raised... kid who's 15, So he's exactly the same age as the years between these two books.
Does he know what a novelist does?
Oh, he thinks a novelist just sits at their desk and drinks coffee and avoids him and isn't going out and getting enough ice cream. You know, that's what he thinks a novelist does.
It's terrible in this day of writing a computer terminal, because in the old days, whenever you saw a novelist at work in an old movie, they would remember, they would take the paper out of the typewriter and throw it away angrily, because obviously wasn't until they grasped the truth that they could begin to write.
Right, and now you can't hear it at all. David Updike, at the tribute to John Updike, said something about that. When he was young, he would visit his dad at his dad's office, and his dad seemed never to be working. And it was only when David would leave the office and go down the stairs and he actually could hear the clack of the typewriter that he knew his dad had a job.
I want to get you to read a section, if I could.
Okay.
This is this little girl, Mary Emma, is racially mixed. And Sarah and her husband, Edward, have a series of Wednesday night meetings. Would we call these consciousness-raising sessions?
Well, in a way, yeah. They're a bunch of people who come together and sort of pool their ignorance and wisdom, and they're chatting up a storm every Wednesday night. It's an interracial family group. But the conversation wanders and wanders back, and it's set forth in the novel as disembodied dialogue that's overheard by the narrator who's upstairs.
Well, let me get you to read it, if we could. We're going to hear a cacophony of voices read by just your voice. And let me ask our producer, Thomas, cue the music, a little Sarah Vaughan, please.
Oh. Is this Sarah Vaughan on the stereo? Sure is. Man, listen to her scat. And you say you don't believe in such a thing as black culture? I don't. Ever heard Julie Andrews scat? I don't believe in gay culture or white culture or female culture or any of that. It's just so dream world, baby. Ever heard Julie Andrews at all? Hey, you don't need blue eyes if you've got blue earrings. I didn't know what they were talking about most of the time. But sometimes, in recalling certain remarks, the context would clarify them. Certain phrases, like a dusting of sand, would float across my mind and heat to a sort of glass. I'd seen scat, and now here it was, as an admirable thing. Vaughan takes autumn leaves and turns it into Finnegan's Wake. Is that your argument? Yeah, kind of an Irish one. Over beer, I am drinking beer. When we were in France, the French customs officials looked at us in a bewildered way. But look, they said, as if they were pointing out something we'd failed to notice. You are white and your son is black. How can this be? As if it defied science, or as if we had never regarded our own skin color before. And I had to say, in English and in anger, this is what an American family looks like. The rest of the world doesn't understand the ungovernable diversity of this country. Diversity made even more extreme by capitalism. And by Karl Rove. I was once in a restaurant and saw Karl Rove sitting across the room, and for 5 minutes I thought, I could take this steak knife and walk over there and change history right now. And, well, as you can see, I chose to stay a free woman. Would anyone care for a timbale?
Sarah, who owns a fancy restaurant, and she and her husband Edward have adopted or taken in MMA as a child, she turns out to be hiding something about their past. But by the time it's revealed, you even have some sympathy for it.
Well, I think it's one of these events. And of course, again, it's an event of passivity and acquiescence and failure to respond that results in tragedy. It's one of these events that people will have different responses to. I mean, some will feel the whole thing is monstrous. The other people will say, oh my God, I could see how this could happen even to me. It's part of my demented imagination, I'm afraid.
Well, that is my question. When you talk about your demented imagination, I can't call it that with a straight face. How much does your imagination rely on suggestions from the real world?
It's prompted by the real world all the time. But I'm not recording from the real world most of the time because that's just dull. Sometimes I collect little things, but even the little things I collect have to go into something new that I'm imagining. I want to create something that doesn't exist exactly in the real world, but exists as a kind of parallel world. And so it's informed by the real world, and it's a response to the real world. It's meant to reflect.
Lori Moore, her new novel, A Gate at the Stairs. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
There's a saying that's familiar to everyone in Rwanda. It goes, God spends the day elsewhere, but he sleeps in Rwanda. The saying has a double meaning. It alludes to the country's physical beauty, but also to the brutality that has at times haunted Rwanda. The story of that country, from decolonization to the genocide to the present day, is told in a new memoir by Joseph Sebarenzi. Before he was sent into exile in 2000, Sebarenzi was the third most powerful man in the country. He was the Speaker of the Parliament. He now lives here in Washington, D.C., and Joseph Sebarenzi joins me in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You grew up in a village that was mixed. There were Hutus and Tutsis. You yourself are a Tutsi. At what point in your life did you realize that there were actually ethnic differences and that this was something that you needed to be aware of?
It was in 1973, shortly before the massacres, and there was an...
These were massacres that left about 30,000
yes.
Rwandans dead.
Yes, and I was in the kitchen at night ready to have our dinner, and then my mother was upset, and she pointed a finger to me and said, did you know that I had to go in the bush with you when you were a baby?
In the bush.
In the bush. She said, because if we had stayed in house, we would have been killed. I said, by who? And she said, Hutu. Why? She said, because we are Tutsi. I had no idea what Tutsi. I had no idea what Hutu meant.
And you even asked her, who's a Hutu?
I did ask, and she mentioned some names.
But people that you knew, neighbors.
Yeah, people I knew. And my sister said, but these are good friends. They can't harm us. And the next day, and I saw it. I saw people with machetes running, shouting, and burning houses. But we left shortly before they got to our house, and the house was not spared.
There are stories in this book about how your Hutu neighbors helped save you at times, and at other times took part in the attacks.
So it's a paradox that the same people who protect us in 1973 from those killers, eventually in 1994, from that family, people harmed my family.
They were involved in the genocide in 1994, 90 days mm-hmm. that left 800,000 people, mainly Tutsis, dead, including your mother, your father, seven of your siblings, many of your relatives. You were in Canada at the time watching this all yeah. on television. Why did you decide to return to Rwanda after what happened, after what happened to your family?
You know, it was a very difficult decision. I was in a very safe place, but I felt I had survived for a reason. I felt I had to go back to Rwanda, help in reconstruction, to make sure what had happened, it does not happen to Hutu and to Tutsi in future.
After the genocide, after you returned, you decided to enter politics, to get involved in government, and you had this astronomical rise. You became the Speaker of Rwanda's parliament at a very young age. What was it like to try and govern in a country so soon after one of history's greatest examples of genocide?
It was very difficult. It was so hard because people were still angry. There were revenge going on. There were human rights in many parts of the country. We were under basically a military regime. And as a Tutsi, as a survivor, as someone educated who had a chance to travel in many countries, I felt we had to do something. We had a president, but that president didn't have much power. Kagame was really the power behind the throne.
Paul Kagame. Who at the time was the vice president.
Was the vice president, but he was the most powerful person in the country.
He was the head of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, who had led a an attack on the Hutu-dominated government that was carrying out this genocide. And we should mention Paul Kagame is currently the president of Rwanda.
Yes, he is.
You had a falling out with him. Eventually, Kagame accused you of being a threat to national security.
Mm-hmm.
You actually became afraid for your life. I mean, you didn't just resign as speaker. You had to leave the country.
A few days after I resigned, I learned from many sources that there was planned to kill me, and I decided to leave.
President Paul Kagame has been lauded by world leaders as an example, a model of a stable African leader. You are very, very critical of Paul Kagame in this book, almost accusing him of exercising dictatorial powers.
It's understated, actually. He's an autocrat. Just to give you some example, you never hear from Rwanda a political leader now who can stand and oppose any given policy. You don't have that. You don't have people go out and protest government policy. You are not allowed. So it's very tough.
But are government leaders in Rwanda dealing with issues of reconciliation that will prevent a future genocide from occurring?
No. If you look at Rwanda today, underneath, it's boiling. Because you cannot have reconciliation if you don't have justice on both sides. We need to come up with a formula that will make Hutu and Tutsi feel part of the system. That way, we can have a hope to have a lasting peace and reconciliation in Rwanda.
Joseph Seberenzi is the author of God Sleeps in Rwanda, which comes out this week. He joined us here in the studio. Mr. Seberenzi, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
And you can read an excerpt from God Sleeps in Rwanda at thenewnpr.org.
Don't know where.